What's up, y'all? Summer's got a different tempo. Everything's a little looser, brighter. One plan turns into another. You hear something, you stay a little longer. Next thing you know, you're somewhere you didn't plan to be. It's those in-between moments. That's where the ideas hit. Conversations stretch out, little memories sneak up on you. And sometimes, it's just about what's in your hand. That color, that chill. The new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks. Guava and passion fruit flavors with mango pineapple flavored pearls. Yeah, that feels like summer before you even taste it. Funny how one small stop becomes the best part of the day. Start your summer rhythm with Starbucks. Try the new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks.
During Memorial Day at Lowe's, shop household must-haves for less. Save $80 on a Charbroil Performance Series 4-Burner Grill to chef up something special. Plus, get up to 45% off select major appliances to keep things fresh. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/27, while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
Moro Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Corey Richens. Just when you thought it couldn't get any worse. Oh my God. The level of depravity, the level of narcissism, the level of just 1,000% being driven by one's own ego and disregard for anybody else and destruction by any means necessary is truly shocking. I don't know. I mean, I'm not really shocked by narcissistic sociopath borderlines anymore, but wow. And look, I can't diagnose her. I don't know what the hell she is, but she just checks every goddamn box. And if you thought what she did with her 40-minute speech at her sentencing was bad, let me tell you about what else she did that is now coming to light. Because, I mean, that in itself was just like, oh, just deplorable. Weaponizing her own children's grief in an attempt to get pity and then threaten to basically stalk them once she gets free, once it's settled, once they all get back together and everything's okay and everything's great and everything's wonderful. You know, I mean, it's insane. What she did leading up to the trial and her minions, flying monkeys, if you will. If you're familiar with narcissists, borderlines, and sort of stuff, you're probably familiar with the term flying monkeys. We've talked about it quite a bit on this show. What her flying monkeys did, and yes, it's a reference to The Wizard of Oz, of having your minions kind of go out and do your work for you. The people that Corey's managed to bamboozle, still does manage to bamboozle. Wow. Wow. As we go through this, give me your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Corey Richens stood in a courtroom on May 13th, handcuffed, wearing that lime green jail clothes, and told her children this: don't hold hate in your heart towards others. It only brings you down more than it does them. Well, there's some interesting irony here. According to the prosecutor's sentencing memo, filled with Summit County Court, filed with the Summit County Court ahead of the hearing, Corey Richens had her family members create a fake gay dating profile for the lead detective who investigated her husband's death and posted it online. That's one of the many things that she did, allegedly, in a retaliatory action. So you get the lead prosecutor, or rather the lead detective, and she had her flying monkeys make a fake gay dating profile. This is like seventh grade shit in 1997. I mean, it really, in 1997, it's like, and you made a fake dating profile for him. Okay. A gay dating. Okay. And why? I mean, what is that'll show him, Corey. That'll totally just woo. Better back off Corey. She's going to make a dating profile for me and Sam Gay. Woo. That's part of today's piece. It's not about the trial. It's not about the verdict. Not the fentanyl. Not the jury handling it all in 3 hours. What I want to do today is put Corey Richens' 40-minute courtroom speech, the one she gave minutes after her own children begged a judge to lock her away forever, directly next to the sentencing memo. It's a sentencing memo that you may not have heard about yet that prosecutors filed. Because when you see what this woman says next to what prosecutors say she actually does, you're looking at two completely different people occupying the same body. And psychologists have a very specific name for that pattern. You're going to learn it today, and you're never going to unsee it. But first, you need the full picture of what came out of that memo. Because while Corey was sitting in her jail cell for the last 2+ years, she wasn't sitting still. According to prosecutors, she was running a campaign. She had family members file unfounded bar complaints against the Summit County attorney and the chief prosecutor. She made what prosecutors described as an unfounded complaint to the FBI about Eric's business partner. She hired counsel to pursue the criminal prosecution of her sister-in-law, Katie Benson. She filed what prosecutors call false reports with the Department of Children and Family Services while her own sons were in Katie and Clint's custody. She had family pursue federal firearms charges against Eric's father, Gene, for removing his dead son's guns from the home for safekeeping. She reported Eric's sister, Amy, to police for marijuana possession, and she had family post that fake dating profile targeting the lead detective. This is a juvenile, idiotic shit that Corey Richens is doing behind bars thinking, I'm going to show them. I mean, she thinks like a seventh grader in 1997. She does. And I guess when you look at Corey Richens from that perspective, it's like, oh, it all makes sense. This, if you were a seventh grader in 1997 and you wanted to solve a problem, this might be how you'd go about doing it. It wouldn't work. You'd end up in the principal's office because adults don't do this sort of shit because it's insane. It's juvenile. It's not going to get you anywhere. But have at it, you narcissistic C-U-N. Yeah. According to prosecutors, not a single one of those actions had any sort of merit. Every person connected to this case, every person connected to her children, every person connected to the investigation, every single one of them got a file opened on them from a jail cell by a woman who was about to stand up in front of cameras and preach about forgiveness. And then after the guilty verdict, prosecutors say she texted an unidentified admirer this: I will expose this county, the prosecution, the judge, the Richens, the investigation, all of it, so they can lock me away for now. That's fine. It's going to come back on them. They picked the wrong one. They think sentencing is the end. Closure, it's just the beginning. They haven't seen anything yet. Followed by a winking emoji. That's who gave the speech. Now let's put the speech next to the receipts, shall we? Let's start with Katie Benson. Katie is Eric's sister. She and her husband, Clint, are raising Corey's three boys. Those boys, in their own handwriting, read by their own therapist, told a judge that Katie and Clint are the first people who ever made them feel safe. One of them specifically said he's afraid Corey would take them away from them if she ever got out. That's who Katie is to those children. Safety, stability, the first real version of it they have ever known. According to prosecutors, Corey hired a lawyer to pursue Katie's criminal prosecution, and she filed false DCFS reports against Katie and Clint while the boys were in their care. She weaponized the child welfare system, a system designed to protect children, against the family that was actually protecting hers. And then she stood in that courtroom and told her sons, "Always be the friend that walks into somebody's life when everyone else chooses to walk out." She's not talking about Katie. She's talking about herself. She's telling those children that she's the loyal one, that she walked in, that Katie, the woman who took them in, who feeds them, who drives them to school, who tucks them in at night, the one who walked is the one who walked away. She's trying to insinuate that, while simultaneously, according to prosecutors, trying to get that same woman criminally charged and investigated by Child Protective Services. The attack vectors on the same target. A DCFS complaint from the jail, a hired attorney from the jail, and a speech from a podium designed to prison her own children's trust in the woman raising them. Is that grief? Is that anger? No, it's a campaign. And it's aimed at the one person those boys said makes them feel safe. That's what these narcissists do. I think she goes beyond that personally. I think you're probably dealing with a sociopath here. I mean, because it's not about grief. It's about a campaign. It's not about anger. It's about a camp, because that's how they think. They don't think in the ways that healthy brains do. They have a mode, and that's destroy. It's destroy anything that threatens their way of thinking. Not understand it, not live in harmony with it, not let's find a way to get along, let's find a way to compromise, let's find, you know, like most of life, it's a gray area. No. Their mode is destroy by any means possible, and it doesn't matter who gets hurt, killed, destroyed in the process. She's already demonstrated that. She's already killed one person. And if destroying the lives of her children in the process of her own destruction, well, that's just collateral damage, because everything is an extension of her. People don't exist to narcissists. People don't exist to this type of thinking. Everybody's a pawn. Everybody's a player in her show. Everything is a performance. And whoever performs the best wins. At least that's how she thinks about it. That's how she's operated through life most of the way. If you've ever had dealt with people like this, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Flying monkeys. Flying monkeys is the term that narcissists use for the people they recruit, if you will, to carry out their attacks for them if they're not able to. It can be anybody. It can be lawyers, family members, government agencies, whatever's available. The narcissist directs. The proxies execute. The narcissist keeps their hands clean and their speech polished. That's the pattern prosecutors laid out in that memo. Corey couldn't reach Katie from jail, so she used DCFS. She couldn't reach the detective, so she used family. She couldn't reach prosecutors, so she used the Bar Association. The hands are always someone else's. The direction, according to prosecutors, always came from the same So when she's trying to convince everybody, no, this it's a novel I'm writing over here, which happens to look suspiciously like instructions on how to control everything. It's a novel, planning for the big one, right? Yeah, we're supposed to believe that while you're doing this. Again, I'm not saying they're smart. There are ones that are cunningly very smart. Corey's not one of them. Corey operates on about a seventh grade level intelligence, and not a great one, like a struggling seventh grade performer. One where it's like, we might have to hold you back. Maturity-wise, emotionally-wise, that's about where, it good on so many roads here. It makes me wonder what happened to her around that age, because that's where she's emotionally stunted at. I would bet anything there was a traumatic event in the life of Corey Richens around the fifth, sixth, seventh grade area. I'd probably put some money on it. If this were on the poly markets, I'd put a couple thousand down and pull that lever, see what comes out. Because that's that, I mean, again, not an excuse. We always try to find the recipe that makes people not excuse it, but just go, oh, well, that makes sense why they're acting this way. Because when you have a real shitty upbringing, you have unstable parents, which we know she did. Those formative years, they can do some wonders to you later in life. Plant the seed here. Watch it grow. Can either get, you know, a beautiful flower that's contained to itself and it's growing as it should, or you can get a field of weeds, random shit spread all over that soil that hasn't been taken care of, that garden that's just gone to shit. That's Corey. It's not a beautiful rose coming out of the ground. She's a field of weeds. Some weeds might have flowers. And go, oh, that's kind of pretty. That's kind of, what is that? And you get closer and like, oh shit, my hand's burning. Let's talk about Gene Richens, Eric's father, a man who buried his son. According to prosecutors, after Eric's death, Gene removed his son's firearms from the family home for safekeeping, which you would do. That's it, a grieving father securing his murdered son's guns. And prosecutors say Corey had family members pursue federal firearms charges against him for doing it. Federal charges against a man whose son was in the ground for the act of protecting his dead child's property. And in her speech, Corey told her boys, forgive those who turn their back on you, but never forget. Never forget. That's interesting. She's preaching forgiveness to her children about the very family she was, according to prosecutors, trying to get federally charged. Forgive but never forget isn't advice coming from this woman. It's a mission statement. She doesn't forget. The memo makes that clear. Every person who crossed her, who sided with Eric's family, who participated in holding her accountable, every single one of them ended up on the receiving end of something. She remembers everything, and she acts on all of it. Now the detective, the lead investigator on her husband's case, according to prosecutors, Corey had family members create a fake gay dating profile using this man's identity and posted it online. Not a legal challenge to his work, not a complaint about his methods, a personal attack designed to humiliate him, to fabricate a sexual identity for him and put it on the internet. Again, seventh grader in 1997. That's what prosecutors say she orchestrated from jail while waiting to give a speech about rising above judgment. Because here's what she told her children in that same speech. People will always have a lot to say about lives they've never lived. The irony should choke you. She's warning her sons about people who judge others, who she allegedly manufactured a fake identity for a law enforcement officer and published it for the world to see. She didn't challenge his investigation. She went after his personhood. She tried to embarrass him in a personal way online. And to her, this was you know, the most personal way she could think of in her pea-brained head. And then she stood at the podium, looked towards her children, and told them to ignore people who talk about lives they haven't lived. It takes a kind of compartmentalization that most people really aren't wired for. Most humans aren't wired for. But Corey is. And that's the point. Eric's sister Amy got the same treatment. According to prosecutors, Corey reported her to police for marijuana possession. Amy, a woman who stood in that courtroom on what would have been her brother's 44th birthday and called it a cruel reminder of yet another year Eric will never see, a woman gutted by grief, and Corey called the cops on her from jail. Not because it mattered, because Amy stood by her family, and in the framework prosecutors describe, that made her a target. Meanwhile, Corey told her boys, don't hold hate in your heart. And then there's the prosecutors themselves. The Summit County attorney, the chief prosecutor who stood in court and said Corey Richards should never again lurk among the rest of us. I like lurk because it's true. According to the sentencing memo, Corey had family file unfounded bar complaints against both of them. She tried to get the lawyers who built the case against her professionally sanctioned. And in the speech, she told her children, those who abuse the power and the positions they hold will have a higher power to report to one day. And that higher power holds the final truth. Same play, two different levels. To the Bar Association, the message was, they're unethical. To her children, the message was, God will judge them. She's running a discrediting campaign on the legal level and wrapping the same accusation in religious language for the emotional level. One audience gets a complaint, the other gets a sermon. Same woman, same agenda, slightly different packaging. And that brings us to the two messages that tell you exactly who Corey Richens is. To the admirer after the verdict. They picked the wrong one. They haven't seen anything yet. Wink emoji. To her children at sentencing. I'm coming home. Not today, not this year, but we're going to make this right. Same promise, different wrapping paper. The admirer gets the war version, chest pounding, scorekeeping, a wink that says, I'm enjoying this. The children get the lullaby version. But is it, considering they said, I'd like to never see you again? Please never let her out. And she's like, I'm going to come find you. Soft, maternal, full of hope. But strip, the tone and the content is identical. I'm not done. I'm coming back. Nobody can stop me. Again, sounds like a seventh grader. The lullaby is the war cry. She just knows which version to play for which audience. And that's not instinct, that's craft. People have asked me if what we're watching is narcissistic collapse. And the more I think of it, it's not. It's not. We might be because she's crescendoing, I think. But it just, she seems like at some point you got to break. Some people just don't ever break. Sometimes there is no narcissistic collapse. I really kind of thought we're like, this is all starting to kind of crumble out here. I don't know. This distinction matters because collapse is temporarily. What we're watching is worse. Narcissistic collapse is when the mask shatters, the person falls apart, rage, despair. All of that. It's ugly. It burns out. They retreat back to their cell and you don't hear from them again. This is narcissistic injury response. The conviction is a wound to her identity. A jury told the world she's a murderer, and for someone with this psychological makeup, that's not just a legal verdict. It's an existential threat to the version of herself she's built. Everything around. And instead of shattering under it, she's escalating. She's attacking every threat, rewriting reality, performing martyrdom for the camera. She's not broken. She's fortifying. And fortification doesn't stop. It just finds new walls to build. Psychologist Jennifer Freed named the pattern DARVO, deny, attack, reverse, victim, and offender. Corey's speech and the sentencing memo together are the most complete demonstration of it I've ever seen. She denies everything. I would have never taken him from you. At the identity level, not the strategic level. She attacks everyone, but through proxies, through systems, through lawyers and complaints and reports. So her public-facing hands stay clean. And then she reverses it. She told those children, you haven't had to just endure losing one parent, but losing two. She places her imprisonment alongside Eric's death as a twin tragedy that's happening to her family. She's not the cause. She's the other casualty. That's world-class victim reversal right there, executed live in a courtroom with cameras rolling. Prosecutors wrote in the sentencing memo that Corey Richens still maintains life insurance policies on her children's lives. Her defense attorney told the court Corey only found out the day before sentencing that two of those policies were actually still active and that she'd canceled them. I'll let you decide if you believe that. Here's what I know. She stood in that courtroom saying, you boys are my world, the reason I continue to wake up every day. She called them my own sweet babies. And while those words were leaving her mouth, active insurance policies existed on those children's lives, taken out by a woman convicted of killing the last family member she insured for money. Prosecutors wrote it plainly. To this day, the defendant maintains insurance policies on the lives of her children. The Richens family will not be safe if the defendant is ever paroled. I don't need to editorialize that. The fact does its own work. Then there's the moment from the courtroom that tells you everything the memo and the speech can't. Multiple reporters documented it. While the Richens family delivered their impact statement, while her own children's words were read into the record by therapists, words about locked bedrooms and starving animals and a brother sneaking food through a door, Corey Richens rolled her eyes. She scoffed. She made faces. Her children's pain was an annoyance to her, an interruption to her day. And then her sister and brother took the stand. They called her a good person. They talked about her kind nature, and Corey dissolved into tears. That's the portrait right there. She showed contempt for her children's suffering and wept at praise of herself. In clinical terms, and that's the difference between someone who feels other people's pain and someone who only refers to her own, remorse is triggered by recognition of harm you caused. Her tears were triggered by recognition of her own loss. Her children described a nightmare and she couldn't be bothered. Her siblings called her wonderful and she fell apart. The emotional circuitry only fires when the subject is Corey Richens. Everyone else is background noise. Prosecutors used a word in their memo that I think really means a lot here. Irredeemable. That's a legal argument, but it's also a psychological observation. And after putting her speech next to that memo, I don't think there's a more precise word in the English language for what we're looking at. Everything in that speech, the forgiveness she preached while filing false reports, the judgment she warned against while fabricating a dating profile, the loyalty she demanded while trying to get a grieving grandfather federally charged, the love she professed while maintaining insurance policies on the children she was convicted of orphaning, all of it exists to serve one person. And the sentencing memo tells you who that person really is. When she thinks nobody's keeping receipts, she told her boys, nobody is all good or all bad. We just get portrayed that way. But this isn't portrayal, Corey. This is a sentencing memo full of documented actions, a text to an admirer with a winking emoji, a courtroom where the only tears you shed were for yourself. This is a pattern, and it's on paper. Judge Marzik said, she is simply too dangerous to ever be free. Her children already knew. They said so in their own handwriting. She told her boys to be like your dad. If they do, if they grow up honest, generous, kind, and brave, they'll be nothing like her. And that's the best thing Corey Richens ever accidentally gave them. And let's hope she rots with her irredeemable soul in that cell for the rest of her very unfortunate life. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in. It's my God. I don't think it's the end of what we're going to be hearing from Corey Richens. I don't know. Let's hope it is. Let's hope the system just kind of mutes her down and all of her ramblings, all of her shit she tries to get attention to in court just fall on deaf ears. Like a seventh grader screaming from their room that they've been sent to. You don't understand me. You don't understand yourself. You're irredeemable.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The sentencing of Corey Richens. We're about to get into everything that happened in the courtroom on today's very special segment. It's called What the F Was That? The Sentencing of Corey Richens. That's right. She gets her own little intro right there because it was that. If you missed the 5-hour debacle, I'm going to sum it up for you, all of it, here in this piece. On the program here, we're going to be doing also in two other separate segments that will be dropping for subscribers pretty much right away. They'll be out there here later on today when I drop this, but we'll be dropping them publicly on Friday. We're going to go through two specific parts of the sentencing, the part where the kids are reading or having their representative, their social workers read their statements, and watching Corey's reactions, focusing on Corey's reactions throughout. And then Corey gave a 40-minute speech as well. I know it's Christmas in the true crime world when things like this happen, because it's just like, it's a train wreck you can't look away from. There was a lot of emotion here this day from a lot of people. And I'm not trying to make light of that by any means. People's lives have been destroyed by this woman. Her flippant reactions to all of this, her 40-minute narcissistic rant, all of it just show how there's no way truly to get through to someone with this type of a personality. Nothing lands. It just doesn't. I made an analogy, or I came up with an analogy, I should say, today. I was thawing a piece of ice. Why do you do that? You just stop it. I had a bottle of juice in my fridge. It was way in the back. You ever get that where it gets and like it freezes solid? Been back there forever. I wanted to get rid of it. And so, but I didn't want to just throw a brick of ice in a juice box in the trash. So I wanted to thaw it. So I took hot water, onto the sink and then put it into the juice bottle to slowly try and melt the ice. I thought this is an interesting analogy because the ice to me almost really represents someone like a Corey. Like, was she always ice? Was she always this? When she came out of the factory, she was juice, if you will. Same with my thing of juice. But over time, she became so solidified and so dug into her way of thinking that she became this solid, rigid thing that is her, so incapable of accepting reality on reality's terms and dealing with the consequences of her actions, that no matter how hot the water, if you will, or the accusations or the confrontation against reality, she's still the damn ice cube. I mean, it wasn't just like, oh, pour a little hot water on there and it all melts. No, I mean, I sat there for, like, I thought this will take 2 seconds. Now, a good 5 minutes, I'm More ice, because the more ice you put on there, it just kind of cools around the edges. It gets a little smaller, but the only way you ever get rid of the ice is just by fully blasting it nonstop with hot water for a good period of time for it to fully melt. So when you're in a courtroom And for a short period of time, the spigot is on. Hot water is flowing at it. It's hitting it a little. It's not destroying it. It's not stopping. You're like, why isn't this melting faster? Because the damn thing is so solid. The damn thing is so rigid and deeply dug in and so solidified chemically beyond the control of anything a human being in that room can do. That's her brain. That there's no words that will ever fully land. Just like I can't just turn on the spigot and melt that thing of ice like that. No. Did it make a... Oh, it looks like it did something. Got a reaction out of it. But that's about all you can do. And it's just people like Corey. Eventually they melt, maybe. Or they just stay solid in their freezer room because people give up trying to melt them. And that freezer room is a prison cell. And eventually they die. And that's the story of Corey Richards. That's the story of what's going to happen. But that's I think, the frustration point with so many people and people like her is, why is this? They're like Teflon. Think of it like a cube of ice, big old chunk of ice. Like, yeah, then spray some water on it. It ain't going to, still going to be pretty solid because that little sprig of water that's flying on it is nothing compared to the lifespan of it in that fridge or that freezer for months. 2 seconds of hot water ain't gonna change it. That's an interesting way of looking at it. Anyway, a 9-year-old boy's words were read into the record of a courtroom in Park City, Utah. He didn't write them for attention. He wrote them because a therapist helped him put on paper what he'd been carrying since the night he woke up to sirens in his own house. This is what he said. Once she is gone, I will feel happy. I will feel safer and relaxed and trust people more. Nine-year-old. His mother, the woman he's talking about, was sitting 15 feet away when those words were read aloud. She rolled her eyes. Got a lot of this. The cameras caught it. Multiple outlets reported the same thing. You've probably seen it. We're gonna do a whole video on this on the channel here. By the time you're watching this, it'll probably be up. If not, watch for it. It's coming very shortly. We're gonna watch her reactions and work our way through it. While all three of her son's statements are being read by their therapist, statements describing locked rooms, dead animals, hunger, fear, a household where their mother was allegedly drunk or absent, Corey Richens responded with visible contempt, eye rolls, scoffing, facial expressions, and according to every reporter in that room and the cameras themselves, conveyed something closer to irritation than grief. And then her brother stood up, called her innocent, talked about missing family game nights and finger gun dances and board games, and the tears came in. Not building, not breaking through, like a faucet. When her sister-in-law described her as a devoted mother, Corey dissolved. When a jail yoga instructor praised her attendance record, she wept. She's so good at showing up to yoga. Oh! When her kids are like, she's locking us in rooms and killing our pets. God. She killed our father. Oh, what? What? Oh, no, you did. That was Corey Richens. I want to sit with that for a second because that split contempt with her children speaking, tears when she's being praised, is not a woman overwhelmed by emotion. That is selective empathy deployed like a tool. The only pain that registered in that courtroom was her own. Her children's suffering didn't just fail to move her, it annoyed her. That tells you more than Corey about Corey Richens than any verdict ever will. As I always say about narcissists, the narcissism always wins. Not the narcissist. They fail. They go down in history as the monsters that they are, and she was on full display in that courtroom of the monster that she is. The narcissism also on full display because it's completely enveloped her. This was the sentencing. It was the sentencing hearing for Corey Richens' case, May 13th, what would have been Eric Richens' 44th birthday. Judge Richard Marzik had two options on the table, 25 years to life or life without parole, 5 hours of testimony, victim impact statements from Eric's family, both his sisters, his brother-in-law, statements from all three boys read by their counselors, and then the defense's turn. Letters from Corey's mother, her brothers, her sister, jail volunteers, church pastors, investors from her real estate business, and three strangers brought to argue against life without parole on philosophical grounds. And then Corey herself, 40 minutes standing at a podium in a lime green jail uniform and handcuffs, reading from a prepared statement addressed to her sons. We're going to break that statement apart because I believe that allocation is one of the most psychologically revealing things that can happen in a case like this. And in a case that includes a children's grief book written by a woman convicted of creating the grief, it says something. But first, the boys, because you can't understand what Corey did at that podium unless you understand what she was responding to. Her sons did not hold back. One of them described Corey putting them in the basement after their father died while she went to see a neighbor. He described fear, confusion, helplessness. He said that when people mention Corey's name, he feels hateful and ashamed. He says if he got out, he'd be terrified she'd come take him away from the family caring for him now. He's nine. Another one of the boys, 11 years old, looked at the situation and described becoming a parent to his younger brother because Corey wasn't doing the job, walking him to the bus, feeding him, watching him. He described Corey locking his brother in his room and him sneaking food through the door. He described a kitten left outside that was eaten by raccoons because Corey wouldn't let him bring it in. Chickens and rabbits that froze or starved because nobody was allowed to care for them. He told the court Corey showed them videos of starving children in war zones when they refused to eat undercooked food. And he said his mother never once said sorry for any of it. It's a little kid. He's not even the oldest. The oldest, 13 now, 9 when his father died, said he thinks Corey should get a life sentence because what she did was very sick. He said his dad was kind and thoughtful and always went the extra mile. He described waking up shaking the night Eric died, having a seizure, and later learning that Corey had purchased additional fentanyl and had it in the house. He said he was locked in his room so often he couldn't remember if the lock was on the inside or the outside. He said he felt like he had to take care of his siblings. And then he said, I miss my dad, but I do not miss my life used to be. I don't miss Corey. I will tell you that. Those are his words, 13-year-old. These aren't coach statements from adults whispering in kids' ears. These are specific, granular, lived-in memories. A dead kitten, the undercooked lasagna, the locked bedroom door, the videos of starving children used as punishment. No adult plants those details. Those are the things a child remembers because they happened to them. And they've seemingly amazingly processed a lot of this for their very young age. You know, a lot of people are like, I couldn't do that. Well, thank your lucky stars. You were never put in that position. People are capable, children are capable of processing a lot of shit at young ages when most would go, they'll never understand. And I think that that's the sin, if you will, of so many parents. Of, oh, the kids, they're resilient. They'll remember that. Yeah, they're resilient. They'll get through it. They'll remember it as much as you're like, oh, they'll forget it. No, they won't. It will make an impact. It will guide future decisions and issues and anxieties and everything else that comes along with that type of treatment from the person that you supposedly love. I know because I've seen it firsthand. In my world, with my own child and one of their parents. Obviously, it's not me. The shit that you have to try and process to understand things and what they are able to come to doesn't need and doesn't require the other parent going, here's a laundry list of all the horrible things they've done. They remember, they talk, they just kind of come to their own conclusions, and it's strikingly accurate, usually. I was very taken aback watching this and hearing these kids' reactions. running it through my own experiences with my own child and the situations that we've gone through with mental illness and a parent, I don't wish it on my worst enemy. I don't wish it on my worst enemy to have to have to be involved in that. If you got two healthy parents, thank your freaking lucky stars. Because being in any circle like this is horrifying. It's horrifying. I related a lot to this case. I lived, obviously, I'm here. But it got bad. I don't think I was very far from being this, honest to God. Not that there was necessarily, you know, poisoning involved, but there was other things. And it really makes you aware of human beings around you. And it certainly questions your trust. And it certainly makes young people question their trust of others as well. Without going into any sort of super great detail. But people are capable of absolutely horrendous, horrible, mind-bending things. And Corey Richin certainly was one of them. And when they get called out, they don't take accountability. Of course. No. In a case like this, they stand up in court for 40 minutes, address your kids, and dismiss everything they've just said to you. Demand respect. To say you're not going to take those things you're saying. You're not going to accept that. Because you're their mother. But you'll be there for them. You'll be the martyr. You'll take the pain and you'll exist when they finally come around to seeing the light. Yeah. What a bright light you are, bitch. She stood up for 40 minutes, addressed her sons, and I need you to understand the structure of what she did because the structure tells it all. She opened by blaming Katie and Clint Benson, Eric's sister and brother-in-law, who now have custody of the boys, for cutting off their communication. She spent several minutes detailing how she's been prevented from calling, how her letters are returned, how her birthday cards never arrive. She told the boys, she warned social services this would happen. Hey, bitch, just because you predict it's going to happen because people are going to prevent you from getting in contact with your kids because you're a clear and present danger to them, doesn't mean that your prediction means jack. You know it's going to happen because you're an awful human being. It's not because people are trying to prevent you from communicating with your children. They're preventing you from communicating with your children because they don't want them further traumatized by you. It's not a let's pick on Corey thing, you stupid bitch. She told them the dark side of the family, the dark side of the family, fought for custody but was denied. But she acknowledged even once why she is separated from her children. Yeah. Before she reckoned for even a sentence with the fact that the jury unanimously found she killed their father, she made herself the wronged party, and the people caring for her sons were the villains. That was her opening move. Not, I'm sorry you're going through this. Not, I understand why you're angry. The opening move was, they did this to us. I will say this. She did say, I know you're angry. Not, I understand why you're angry. Not registering it. But you are. And that's an inconvenience to her. Then the refrain, where she tried to be somewhat ironic. And I don't know what the fuck she was really trying to do, but it didn't land well. Be like your dad. She said it again and again through the statement. Be generous like your dad. Love the mountains like your dad. Laugh loud like your dad. Build a family like your dad. And then marry a psychotic C-U-N-T like me. And don't get killed. Honest to God, that's going to be a bit of a battle, I think, for these kids not to fall for someone like their mom. Because it's ingrained at such an early age. But, they're young. They're moldable. And I hope to God, with enough therapy and guidance and good people around them, that that does not become an issue. Be like your dad. And I know how that sounds in isolation. If you're just like scanning ahead to the video and you're hearing that, oh, isn't that nice? It sounds like love. It sounds like a mother honoring the man she lost. But Corey Richens didn't lose Eric. She took Eric. She was convicted of attempting it once on Valentine's Day with a laced sandwich, failing, spending 17 days recalibrating, and finishing the job with a cocktail containing approximately 5 times a lethal dose of fentanyl. She was convicted of doing this for money, for insurance payouts, for his estate, for a financial escape hatch from millions of debt that she created. So when she stands at a podium and tells these boys to be like your dad, she's not grieving. She's constructing a defense. The implied argument is devastating in its audacity. How could I have killed a man I'm telling my sons to emulate? That line is not for 3 children. That is for appeal. It's for cameras. It's for everybody out there who's an idiot who believes her shit. It's for the inevitable documentary. It is reputation management dressed up as a mother's love. I want to say this too about Corey. If you think she's innocent, congratulations. You've never dealt with anybody like this in your life. And if you have, you've probably been taken advantage of quite heavily. Or you've never been on the receiving end of this type of behavior. If you have or had and understood it and looked it up and studied it and learned how to not become victims of people like this over and over again, then you know what the hell she is. She's not, she is a wolf in sheep's clothing, but the wolf costume came from a closed down Halloween Express store. I mean, really, because it's like you're like, oh, where did you get that? Like, is that supposed to be a wolf? Okay. Yeah, it's just, it's not done well. It's not Fredericks of Hollywood's, although that's kind of a lingerie. I'm trying to think of like a Hollywood. It's not Central Casting. It's not Central Casting costume quality. It's not. This is Halloween Express all the way. It's obvious to those who know what to look for. If you've never seen a wolf before and somebody's in a Halloween Express wolf costume, you're like, what is that over there? If you've seen a wolf, you're like, that's a real shitty looking wolf. Like, what's up? What's going on over there? This is the same woman who, after Eric died, wrote a children's book called Are You With Me? About a boy grieving his father's death. She dedicated it to Eric. She went to the local ABC affiliate to promote it. She positioned herself as the compassionate widow helping children process loss. While prosecutors alleged she was the one who actually caused it. The grief book, the Be Like Your Dad refrain at the sentencing, it's the same move. Perform devotion so publicly and so loudly that nobody thinks to ask the obvious questions underneath. Except they are, and we are, and we will, and it's happening, and you're going to be locked away forever. Then came the part that, in my opinion, crosses from manipulation to something a lot darker. She told her boys, the same boys who had just told the court that they were scared of her, that they were locked in rooms, that they watched animals die, that they don't feel safe. She told them that they've been influenced into believing their father was taken from them. She called it completely wrong and an absolute lie. She said, it's as absurd today as it was 4 years ago. She didn't address the locked room. She didn't address the dead animals. She didn't address the starvation fear. She didn't address a single specific thing her children said. She dismissed the entire reality these boys described as fabrication. She told traumatized children, her own traumatized children, that their memories are wrong, and that the people who finally made them feel safe are the ones lying to them. Exhale. Narcissistic much? It is 1,000% narcissistic behavior. Not diagnosing her. Can't do that. But I can guarantee with a certain degree of certainty, in my opinion, this bitch checks the boxes. People like this, they have a little bit of a pattern. It kind of goes like this. That didn't happen. And if it did, it wasn't that bad. If it was, that's not a big deal. And if it is, that's not my fault. And if it was, I didn't mean it. And if I did, you deserve it. Corey's allocation hit at least four of those in 40 minutes. Some of them in 40 seconds. It didn't happen. She maintains complete innocence. If it did, it's not her fault. The system is corrupt. The investigation was flawed. If it was bad, well, then the boys have been influenced into thinking so. And underneath everything, the steady implication, I'm the real one suffering here. Then she told the boys to ignore the noise. She told them to question what they've been told. She told them to listen to your little hearts and remember who we are. She told them to be suspicious of people who judge them and trust only those who've proven their loyalty. In a vacuum, that's a mother's encouragement aimed at children in therapy who are finally processing their trauma in a stable environment. It is an instruction to reject the healing and cling to the version of reality she is selling from a jail cell. And she couldn't resist one more move. She folded her affair into a narrative of shared fault. I fell in love with someone who wasn't your dad, she told the boys. Your dad fell in love with someone who wasn't me. Equal blame. Mutual imperfection. She took the motive prosecutors proved at trial, the documented relationship, the text messages, fantasizing about leaving Eric and keeping the money, and repackaged it as something that happened to both of them. Two flawed people in a complicated marriage. Not a woman who, according to the evidence presented to a jury and the world, was building an exit strategy that required her husband's death. I know. And then she threatened to stalk them. I will call you even if you block my numbers. It's like, what? You're talking about stalking your children once you get released? You're not getting released. Oh, but she'll find her way out. Oh. Now, the message she sent after the verdict, prosecutors included it in their sentencing memo, and it deserves to be read in full for what it reveals. She texted an unidentified admirer from jail. Quote, I will expose this county, the prosecution, the judge, the Richens, the investigation, all of it, so they can lock me away for now. That's fine. It's going to come back on them. They picked the wrong one. They think sentencing is the end, closure. It's just the beginning. They haven't seen anything yet. She ended it with a winking emoji. A woman convicted of murdering her husband, the father of her three children, who is now being in court, begging in court to keep them safe from her, sent a message promising vengeance and punctuated with a winky face to an anonymous admirer. It's not someone grappling with consequences. That is someone who still believes the rules don't apply to her. The jury was wrong. The judge is corrupt. The investigation was a setup. Everybody else is the problem. The narcissistic framework cannot accommodate the possibility that she is responsible for any of this. So everyone involved must be lying, corrupt, or conspiring against her. Judge Marzik saw through it. His sentencing was measured, almost understated, which made it hit harder. He acknowledged the genuine tension in the decision that life without parole might someday feel wrong to the boys if they ever want a relationship with their mother, and that 25 to life might leave them spending decades afraid that she will get out. He didn't pretend the decision was simple, and then he described the facts of the conviction, the attempt, the 7-day gap, the completion, the motive, poison, money. And he said a person convicted of that sequence is simply too dangerous to ever be free. And the fact that she just stood up and said she's going to stalk them. He ordered every count consecutive, life without parole on the aggravated murder, 5 to life on the attempted murder, 1 to 15 on each insurance fraud count, up to 5 on the forgery. The defense asked for concurrent sentences. The judge said, no way. Outside the courthouse, Eric's sister Amy spoke to reporters. She was composed. She didn't celebrate. She said something that stayed with, I think, a lot of us. I don't think she had any remorse. She lives in her own little world. And she does. That world, her own little world. Because what we watched in that courtroom wasn't a sentencing hearing. It was a collision between two realities. One reality is the one those three boys described, a house where the locks were on the wrong side of the door, where the animals died in cages, where a mother was drunk or gone or dangerous, and where the man who held everything together was taken from them. The one reality is the one Corey has been constructing since the night Eric died, or the other reality is the one Corey has been constructing since the night Eric died, one where she's a devoted mother, a grieving widow, a best-selling author of a children's book about loss, a woman railroaded by a corrupt system, a martyr whose insurance will eventually, or innocence will eventually shine through, since the insurance money didn't. Those two realities can't coexist. The jury chose one, the judge chose one, and those boys chose one. In their own words, on their own paper, in their own handwriting, they chose one too. Corey's allocation was 40 minutes long. She used it to tell her children to ignore what they know, to distrust the people keeping them safe, and to wait for her to come back and fix everything. She told them she didn't do this. She told them she never would. She told them to be like the man she was convicted of killing. And when they said they were afraid of her, she said she'll find them. And then she was let out in handcuffs to begin the rest of her life in a cell. One of her boys had already said everything that needed to be said. He's 13. He told the court he misses his dad. He told the court he does not miss Corey. He said he started to feel really good when he moved into a safe place because the people around me were safe. This kid isn't confused. He isn't brainwashed. He's a boy who finally lives somewhere. The locks are on the right side of the door, and no performance for a podium, no matter how long, no matter how rehearsed, no matter how many times you say, be like your dad, will make him forget what it was like when they weren't. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in. Again, this here has been WTF was that, the sentencing of Corey Richens. We have more to come. We're going to actually go through the boys' statements and Corey's statements. That's coming up here on the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe. We're going to watch them in entirety with reactions. We'll probably pause a little bit through there. We're going to get a chance to share in that magic together. So join me, shall you? Little nod out to Adam, the Woo, RIP. And we'll continue that here on the channel. So press subscribe. We'll continue our conversation in the comments. Links are in the description. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Moro Casino. America's Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spend on Moto, America's Social Casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's Social Casino. Moro Casino, America. like a social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly.
Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.